Good night, everyone. I wanted to welcome everyone to our second ever Kol Mevasser lecture. I'm Shlomo Zakir, one of the editors of Kol Mevasser, along with Sarip and David, Yolana Gadish, and Jonathan Ziering, somewhere back there. Hello. As many of you know, Kol Mevasser, the Jewish thought magazine of Yeshiva University's student body, is dedicated to sparking discussion of Jewish issues on the Yeshiva University campus and beyond. The magazine hopes to facilitate the religious and intellectual growth of its readership and serves as a forum for students to express their views on a variety of issues that face the Jewish community. It also provides opportunities for young scholars to grow in their intellectual pursuits and mature into confident Jewish leaders. Let me give you a little update of our recent activity. We recently came out with our issue, Judaism and its relationship to nature, and we'll be publishing our issue on Derech HaLimud this coming week. We're now accepting submissions for the following two issues, on the year in Israel and war in Jewish thought. We'd very much like to have all of your contributions. Don't worry, we can handle it, all 50 contributions. You can also submit two articles. We encourage all readers to participate in discussion by submitting articles, letters to the editor, or posting comments on our website, www.kolmevasser.com, or on our Facebook page. Tonight, we have the privilege of hearing Rabbi Dr. Joshua Berman of Bar-Ilan University. He has a BA in religion from Princeton, learned for several years and got smicha in Yeshivat Haratzion, and has a PhD from Bar-Ilan, where he now teaches. He's the author of two important books in Tanakh study. Number one, The Temple, Its Symbolism and Meaning, Then and Now, and more recently, Created Equal, How the Bible Broke with Ancient Political Thought. And I have it in my bag. I have the book. I was going to use it as a prop, but now I can't. But it's a really cool cover, and copies of the book can be bought on Amazon.com, and also they'll be available at the Sfarim sale in a couple months. That's where I bought it last year. In addition, I was lucky enough to catch Professor Berman last year to interview him for Kol Mevasser for our issue on academic Jewish studies. You can read his insightful words there. The issue can be accessed online. Tonight, Professor Berman will be presenting on the topic, Studying Chumash in Ancient Near Eastern Context, Asur, Chovah, or Rishut. And you can all place bets on what the end result's going to be. You'll hear more, but this is a field that he has to a large degree pioneered, dealing with the Torah in the ancient Near East and from a perspective of political theory, and it's dealt with at length in his book, Created Equal. We are honored to have him present this lecture tonight, and now, without further ado, Professor Berman.
I just want to begin by maybe giving a little more of a push for making submissions to Kol HaMevasser. I never went to YU. I've never written a word in my life for Kol HaMevasser. But I do know one thing. I know that after the interview that Shlomo conducted with me appeared, I was bombarded by emails because it gets out there. You have no idea what this organ does for the Jewish world. It is read and read and read. And so if you're thinking to yourself, I don't have time, and who's going to read it? I am telling you, you can write for many other things. Very few things today have as much impact within our world, the modern Orthodox world, the Dati Leumi world, worldwide. I got things from London, from Australia. This is the place to appear. So if you think you have an idea and you want to get it out there to the rest of the Jewish world, the rest of the Orthodox world, Kol HaMevasser might be the place for you. And I'm really very, it's a great privilege for me to be able to be here this evening. So studying Chumash in ancient Near Eastern context, is this something that's usser, something that's a chovah, or something that's a reshut? And let me just sort of map out what I think are some of the default positions that people have about this, and then lay out what my position is with some examples from work that I've done in this context. For some people, the idea, looking at the Torah in ancient Near Eastern context, ick! I mean, the Torah is kadosh, the Torah is netzach. And what is this idea of sort of looking at it in comparison to fuddy-duddy pharaohs and who knows what, Hammurabis and things like that? That in itself is a violation of the very kedusha of the Torah. The Torah, it says, is said, is nitzchi, it's netzach. And so therefore, it's not rooted in one time or another. But if we all think for a moment, we all know that it's not exactly true that the Torah, as it's written in the Sfarim that we have in our shuls, is netzach. We don't do yibum the way they once did. Today we encourage chalitza. We don't have polygamy today like they had in the Torah. When we say the Torah is netzach, then we mean the Torah through the mediation of the explanations given to it by Gedolei Yisrael, L'dorei Dorot. And so there might still be some way of finding value in looking at the Torah in the ancient Near Eastern context. Some people think, when I speak of the Torah being studied in ancient Near Eastern context, that this kind of, in a way, denigrates the Torah in another way. Perhaps in the way that that the Rambam was criticized. As many of you certainly know, the Rambam's take on korbanot is that korbanot are really a big b'dieved. And why did the Torah give korbanot if really the right way of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu is through davening and through meditation and through learning Torah? Well, it was a concession that the people back then were ovdei avodah zarah. So the more you understand of avodah zarah, the better you'll really be able to understand the korbanot, which sort of takes the korbanot and puts a big damper on whatever lofty meaning might be there. So understanding avodah zarah, understanding the ancient Near East, will help you understand all sorts of negative sides about the Torah, things that were a concession to the way things were once upon a time. And I want to come tonight and make a very different claim, and that is that by understanding the Torah in ancient Near Eastern context, not only do we understand bad sides or lesser noble sides of how Am Yisrael may have behaved at one point, not only do we understand all sorts of, I don't know, kind of cute archaeological things or historical things, like just for an example, Pur, he peeled Pur. Anyone know what a Pur is? He peeled Pur, right, from the Megillah? Okay. So if you understand archaeology, you can get a really cute insight. What does it mean? He peeled. It's not draw lots. He peeled. Well, it turns out that a pur is a die, as in dice. Right? And what Haman did was, we know this from archaeology, he took dice with the names of the months, and he sort of did bowling for dollars in front of the pesel, right? And he rolled the dice, and whichever pur came closest to the pesel, that apparently was the choice of the gods, and that's how he got to Chodesh Adar. Well, that's really cute, and you wouldn't know that without archaeology. So there's cute sorts of things like that that you can pick up, but certainly there's nothing of real substance to be understood from the ancient world. And what I want to come and claim tonight is that, no, we cannot understand some of the best ideas, some of the most significant ideas and beautiful ideas that the Torah has to offer us unless we understand the ancient Near Eastern world from which Am Yisrael came out of Mitzrayim and in which the Torah was given at Har Sinai. Moreover, by examining the Torah in light of the ancient Near East, tons, dozens, as we're going to see tonight, dozens of things that we all know by heart, that we thought we understood, we suddenly see in a new light. And all of this, what we're going to see tonight, focuses around the idea of equality. Now, that's a kind of a hot topic today, right, within our camp. Equality, gender equality. And equality doesn't really seem to be one of the Torah's big ideals. You know the famous joke, the guy goes to his rabbi and says, "Rabbi, make me a Kohen." Right? And the rabbi says, "Well, I can't make you a Kohen." And he goes back the next day and he says, "Rabbi, please make me a Kohen." And the rabbi says, "I can't. How do you do that? I can't make you a Kohen." And on the third day, the rabbi says, "Tell me, dear sir, why do you want to be a Kohen?" He says, "Well, my father was a Kohen and my grandfather was a Kohen, and that's why I want to be a Kohen." And what I like about that joke is that it really highlights how equality does not seem to be a big Jewish value. You can only be a Kohen if you're a Kohen. It doesn't matter how much of a tzaddik you are, how much Torah you've learned, can't be a Kohen. What I want to suggest tonight is that what we see is the birthplace of the idea of equality in the Torah relative to what was going on in the ancient Near East. Not so much gender equality, but in terms of breaking from what existed everywhere else, which were cultures that were highly stratified and hierarchical, and to create a new culture for Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael that is far more empowering of the common masses. When I say stratified and hierarchical, think of what we know from the story of Yosef. Everything here, everyone has their place. Paro is born a Paro and he's going to die a Paro. And Potiphar is born as landed gentry and he's always going to be an elite upper crust and nothing will change that. And everyone beneath Potiphar is always going to be a servant and nothing can change that. The station of life that you're born into is what you wind up with. And you'll never be rich if you weren't born rich. And you'll never be poor if you were born rich. So everything is very hierarchical and stratified. And what I want to come to try to show is how the Torah systematically takes all the institutions and ideas that were known throughout the ancient Near East as to how to set up a culture in a stratified way, and to tweak them and change them and dilute them and to give power to the common masses. I want to show how this happens in terms of the Torah's conception of political office. Then we're going to see how the Torah does it in terms of its economic policies. Then we're going to see how the Torah does this in terms of technologies of communication, whatever that means. We'll get to that. And finally, even a little bit about how we relate to the Almighty himself. Let's start with political office. Let's start with what the Torah says about melech. We all know that the Torah prohibits the melech from three things: lo yerbelo nashim, lo yerbelo susim, kesev ezahav lo yerbelo. And of course, I suspect we've all learned why those three things. What are they all designed to accomplish? Well, they're designed to keep the king focused on a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So this is how it's normally taught. Lo yerbelu susim. Why? Because if he has too many horses, he'll have a very strong army, and he'll achieve his success on the battlefield to his army rather than to the Ribono Shel Olam. And why lo yerbelu nashim? Well, because if he has too many wives, then he'll be focused on his wives instead of doing other, perhaps more worthy things. And lo yerbelu kesev v'zahav. Why is that? Because he shouldn't be so materialistic. This is the way it's normally taught. But now, when we look in ancient Near Eastern context, then we can see that each of these three prohibitions that the king has an entirely different aspect of it, ben adam lechavero, that weakens the king's power and empowers the masses. Lo yerbelo susim. Why? Well, we know about armies in the ancient Near East that when an army had horses and chariots, it was qualitatively on a different level than an army that didn't have one. It's the same today as between comparing an army that's just infantry and an army that has tanks. When you have chariots, you have firepower, you have mobility. And we know that the armies that had horses and chariots usually won. And what would happen universally in those societies is that the charioteers, the guys driving the chariots, the guys shooting from the chariots, would become a military elite. They would get special houses. They would get special tax breaks because the whole culture was dependent on them. And so when you have horses, you are almost automatically going to create for yourself a military elite. The Torah didn't want that to happen. Lo yerbelo nashim. Why is that? Well, one thing of marriage once upon a time wasn't about love. Maybe it isn't even today, I don't know. But once upon a time it was certainly not about love. What marriage was for kings was about politics. Do you know that Saddam Hussein, one way that he got so much power in Iraq, was that he took all of his sons and all of his cousins and he made sure who they married. And you know who they married? The head of this tribe and the head of that tribe and the head of this priest from this region and the head of that imam. And suddenly Saddam Hussein was married to every important person and every important family in Iraq. And this is the way marriage was back then as well. Lo yerbelo nashim, because if a king has many wives, then it's not just because he likes to have a good time with many different women. It allows him to establish contacts through marriage with all the powerful families in Israel, who then all become his yes men, and they all eating off of his plate, and he becomes a very powerful individual. So that limits the king's power as well. Lo yerbelo kesef v'zahav. Well, where does he get kesef v'zahav? From me and from you, from taxes. And so we don't want him to be able to tax the people excessively either. But what the Torah has to say about a king, and what a king can and should do, and what a king cannot do, is not just limited to those few psukim in Dvarim Perek Yud Zayin. In fact, the Torah says much, much more about kings, but it's in the white space between the verses. It's in what the Torah does not say about kings that we know about kings from everything else we know about the ancient Near East. What do we know about kings from the ancient Near East? We know that kings always, they spent 99% of their time involved in two activities. Activity number one, warfare, trying to expand the borders, trying to make the empire richer, trying to show the gods that they were giving the gods as much land and as much riches as possible. Kings were warriors. Well, let's see. The Torah speaks about war a lot. It speaks about Kibush Haaretz a lot. And it never mentions the king. Dvarim Perichav speaks about all sorts of planning for war. You have to have a Mashuach Milchama, you have to have Ksinim, you have to have Shotrim, and they address the troops, and there are all sorts of halachot. How a soldier is supposed to conduct himself? No mention of the king. In fact, when the Torah speaks about when we're allowed to ask for a king, there's a very interesting limitation on that. When can we ask for a king? It says here,
Perek Yud Zayin, the following. It's the first pasuk that discusses the king. Ki tavor al ha'aretz asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach v'yirishta v'yashavta ba v'amarta asim alai melech l'chol hagoyim asher svivotai. When are we allowed to ask for a king? Only after knisa la'aretz. Only after kibush ha'aretz. One would have thought that it's just the opposite. We want to do kibush ha'aretz with a king. But it's clear that Torah did not want George Washington to become the father of the nation. That is, that the military leader should be idolized as the one responsible for the victory. So the king is taken out of military conquest, which was the main thing that kings did in the ancient world. The other things that kings did in the ancient world in a big, big way was to build temples. Many temples, there were many gods. Build many temples, refurbish many temples. And yet when we look in Chumash, the Melech has nothing to do with the Mikdash. In Perek Yud Bet in Devarim, when it speaks about building the Mikdash, it sounds like all of Am Yisrael has a part in it. There's no special part for the Mikdash. One other thing, the 1% of time that kings had left over when they weren't fighting battles and they weren't building temples, is they wrote laws, like Hammurabi's laws. And he says, look what a great lawgiver I am, and I'm so just, and I'm such a brilliant guy, I came up with such great laws. And, of course, we know that the Melech has to carry HaKadosh Baruch Hu's laws. So everything that kings did elsewhere, fighting battles, building temples, writing laws, the Torah comes and it clips the wings of a Melech. It's almost a parody what we have here with Melech. So that the whole institution of what was the most important and powerful position in the ancient world, the king, is now, the wings are cut off, and the power is given to a large degree, moreover, to the people. But what the Torah has to say about political office is not just about the king. It's about how people arrive at that office. Who chooses them? The Torah is the first place where we have in history the idea that a leader will be chosen by the people. V'amarta asima alai melech. That doesn't exist anywhere else. Now, it's true that HaKadosh Baruch Hu also had a hand in choosing Shaul and choosing David, but when you read Shmuel Aleph carefully, you also see that without the approval of the people, neither Shaul nor David would have been appointed king, giving the power to the people to choose their leaders. Whether it's voting each one, I don't like using the word democratic, but it's clear that there has to be a desire of the people for this leader. Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha. You appoint the judges. You appoint the governors. This didn't appear anywhere else in the ancient world. But the last point that I want to make here about political office and what the Torah has to say is truly remarkable and didn't appear in the history of political thought until the American founding. To illustrate this point, I want us to think about what we know about the British Parliament. And you say, I don't know anything about the British Parliament. No, this is something everybody here knows. The British Parliament has two houses. There's a House of?
Lords.
Good. And a House of?
Commons.
Excellent. Okay. Now think about that. Lords and Commons. Why is the Parliament split into Lords and Commons? Well, all the way back in history to Greek and Roman times, they understood that it wasn't a good thing to put too much power in the hands of one person because absolute power? Good. So therefore we try to dissipate power a little bit and spread it out. And so when we have a legislative house, we make two houses out of it. But what happens is that throughout history, just as we have in the British parliamentary system, the two houses are Lords and Commons. Why? Why Lords and Commons? And the answer is that the way in which the British thought about it, it's the way in which the Greeks and the Romans also thought about it, was, well, let's see. We want to somehow balance power so that nobody has too much power. Well, who do we give power to balance it out? And the answer always was, well, we'll look at existing divisions within society. There's always an upper class and a lower class. That's how we'll divide the power. We'll give some power to the upper class and some power to the lower class. We don't want to give all the power to the upper class because then they'll just make mincemeat out of the lower class and everybody will be eternally destitute. And if we give all the power to the common people, they'll just overrun the feudal manors and then the elites will all be butchered. So we'll give a little bit of power to each. This is how a division of political power worked in Greece and in Rome and even into the modern time in England as well. And it's worked. It's worked pretty well. Balance of power. No one gets too much. But there's one big drawback when you balance power this way. When you say lords are going to have one house, commons are going to have another house, you're essentially saying if you want to be in the House of Lords, you can do so as long as you're a lord. And you can be in the House of Commons as long as you're a member of the common folk. put differently, what that does is that it permanently enshrines hierarchical distinctions within society and keeps them going forever and ever. The first time in modern history where we have a notion of political office that isn't tied to this caste or to this group in society or to this family, in the case of kings, but rather an idea of political office that just stands and is open to anybody, and its purpose is to serve the people rather than a particular group. The first place that happens is in the American Constitution, right? Because anybody can run for Congress. Anybody can run for president. But there's only one precursor to that. Bestseller. It's right here. Because, and how do we see this? Because the Torah says, who can be a king? Mikerev Achecha. Mikerev Achecha. That's the Lashon that the Torah uses. Well, who is Mikerev Achecha? That's anybody. Well, maybe it's just the guys. But that's still pretty good for a beginning. Yeah. So it's any man in Israel. Later on, the Navi will speak about Beit David, and that's an interesting development and why that happened. But with the Torah, we have the idea that there is an office and anybody can fill it. Same thing with shotrim. Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha. Well, who are these shoftim meant to be? Are they the Nesim? Are they from a particular Shevet? There's no mention, which implies, therefore, shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha. You decide whoever you feel is worthy of doing it. And so it is open potentially to anybody. Let's turn now to economic policy and how the Torah's economic policy works to empower the common masses. When I say economic policy, there is a very clear economic policy in the Torah. And it comes through many different mitzvot that we are used to seeing one at a time, a parsha at a time, but it really all does come together. Let me explain what used to happen in the ancient world economically. What used to happen is the following. You had people who were wealthy and you had people who were poor. Now, things chug along, and when things are good, so even the poor people get by, you know, they have a few chickens, they raise a few tomatoes, and they manage to get by. But when disaster strikes, could be a famine, could be a drought, could be a war, suddenly the poor, who don't have big savings accounts, they're really in shtuch, and they need a loan. And when they go for a loan, then those that give the money really have them by the neck. In fact, the Code of Hammurabi says the interest rate should be 33%. That's a high interest rate. Now, what happens when you take out a loan at 33%? You do it because you have to feed your family, right? But inevitably, nobody can pay back a loan with that type of interest. So what are you forced to do? If you don't have the money to pay back, you sell the chicken, and then the second chicken, and then the cow, and then the tomatoes, and then the land, and then the shirt off your back, and then your daughter. And soon, there's nothing left, and you're permanently left in poverty. This is what happened the world over, time and time again. What the Torah systematically works to do is to make sure that the common person is economically secure. Let's look at how it does that. It starts with the jobs program in the Torah. Did you catch where that was? Speak nowadays, need a jobs program. Where's Obama? Who knows? The Torah has a jobs program. Okay, it's called Parshat Bahar. It's called something that we all know, but we never really thought about it in this way. It's the fact that every family in Israel gets a plot of land. Now, if you ask most people, why is it that every family in Israel gets a plot of land? They'd say, well, Eretz Yisrael was given to the Avot as a Yerusha, and we're the Yorshim. And what happens to a Yerusha? It gets divvied up into the Shvatim, and divvied up into the families, divvied, and we're all left with a little plot of land. And that's true. Eretz Yisrael is a Yerusha. That's all true. But there's another aspect to it. Because when you have a plot of land, you have a source of income. Subsistence living. You're able to grow things, graze things. It meant that everybody had a source of income. There was never a precedent in the world where all the land of a country was taken and split up and given out to the masses. Everywhere else in the ancient Near East, all the land belonged to the temple or to the king, and sometimes if the kings really liked somebody, they would give them a little gift of land. But this idea that the land should go to the masses was without precedent. The idea that every 50 years, no matter what your economic state, even if you had the misfortunes that I mentioned before, and then you had to sell everything and even sell your land, as we know, in Yovel, the land goes back. This keeps everybody with a secure job and a secure parnasa. If I said that one thing that really sent people deep into poverty was very high interest rates, well, we know what the Torah says. The Torah is the first system in the world to say no interest. Interest is some, when you give a loan, you give it to help a fellow Jew get back on his feet, not to wring everything you can out of him. This didn't exist anywhere else. Taxation is also radically new in the Torah. Everywhere else there's taxation, and everywhere else it uses the same shorish that we have by us, eser, ma'aser. It's called that everywhere in the world. Now, ma'asrot, everywhere else in the world, are exclusively to the king and to the temple. In the Torah, we also have ma'asrot that we give to the Kohanim, to the Leviim. But what we have in the third and sixth year is a type of taxation, a type of ma'aser, that didn't exist anywhere else. Right? Ma'aser ani. What happens in those years? We take those that are more well-off, those that had more produce, and they have to give their tenth, their tax. That's what ma'aser is, tax. Not to the state institutions, but to other Jews who are in need. This idea of what we call today redistributive tax, because that's what happens here, right? Those of us in America that are earning more pay a higher tax rate, and that money is hopefully, effectively, redistributed so that some of it goes to those that are less well off. This idea never existed anywhere else in the world. And it helps keep the weakest members of society on their feet financially. I mentioned before that in the ancient world, as economic activity would continue, when hard times came, the rich got very rich and the poor got very poor. And when this would happen, the kings would be in a bad state because they needed the common folk to fight their battles. And so they needed to have some way of pressing the reset button on economic activity. And it's very interesting to see what happened everywhere else in the ancient world and how the Torah came and tweaked that institution. Everywhere else in the ancient world, they had debt relief. And this is how it would work. When a new king would come to power, and this is true in Greece and in Egypt and in Mesopotamia and everywhere, when a new king would come to power, he would declare debt relief, all debts canceled. What would this do? It would do two things for the king. A, the commoners would now love him. Yay! I get my credit card back, you know, and go shopping. So all the common people would now be very endeared to the king. It would also mean that the debts that were owed to the rich and powerful around the king would be canceled, so those other powerful people around him would now be less powerful. It was a very good political football for the king. Now what do we have in the Torah? We also have debt relief, right? Shmitat Ksafim, in the Shmita year, debts are canceled. But look what the Torah does. It takes the idea of canceling debts to let people get back on their feet, but it takes it away from being a political football for the king. Because now it happens legislated. It's every 7 years. It's automatic. And you can know in advance if you've fallen into hard times, well, if I just keep my head above water for X amount of time until we get to the Shmita year, then I'll be able to get back on my feet. So it takes something that existed in the ancient world and it tweaks it. Maybe the most remarkable thing in the Torah's economic policy, and this blows me away, this isn't my chidush, but every time I think about it, it blows me away, is a chidush that we see in the Torah about how to measure time. How to measure time. What do I mean by that? Well, in the ancient world, when they had calendars, we didn't invent the calendar, they knew how to measure three units of time. Days, months, and years. And all the ancient calendars are based on that. Days, months, and years. What no other ancient calendar has is the idea of a week, of measuring weeks. So I don't know how they had biology class every Tuesday if they don't have a week. But there's no weeks. There's no weeks. What they do have, and some of you might know this from Chumash, there are periods of 7 days. There's a notion of sitting Shiva for 7 days. Right, like when Yaakov Avinu is niftar, we see this that they sat Shiva. Or there's a notion of Sheva Brachot in some institute. Not they didn't say the Sheva, but you know the idea of partying for 7 days after a wedding. But the 7 day period is different than measuring time in units of these sevens. Why is that, by the way? Why is it that ancient cultures knew how to measure days, months, and years, but not weeks? Any thoughts? Yeah. Right. The ways in which they measured time were based on celestial events, right? They knew days, pretty easy to see a day, right? It's pretty easy to see a month, right, with the Levana. And even I can measure a year without a calendar. You know why? Because in my shul, on the 12th of May, every year, the sun comes in and I have to wear sunglasses in shul until the 5th of August. And if I can figure it out, I imagine the ancients could figure out the same thing even without going to shul. So they knew how to measure years as well. Okay. Now, what's this business of seven then? Well, of course we know seven, right, comes from Aser Bereishit and from Shabbat. But what's so interesting is that all the things that we have that are units of seven, right, 7 days Shabbat, 7 years in the Shemitah cycle, seven Shemitot, and then the Yovel, what all of those things have at the end of them, at the end of the sevens, are days in which economic activity ceases. In other words, what we say is that we're going to allow the strong, the smart, the industrious to get ahead. That's just capitalism. That's just the way the world has to work for most of the time. But then there's going to be those spaces in time where we're all going to level out, where we're not going to have people getting richer and people getting poorer. Economic activity basically stops, and we're all just one Am Yisrael. Okay? So that the very way in which we measure time, the Torah comes up with a chidush whose whole purpose, when it's implemented, when we see what the Torah says about it, is to help ensure the cohesion of society by helping people level out, especially those that are less fortunate. I remember about a year ago I flew in, and I remember seeing on the highway a really pithy billboard. It said, Recession 101. Self-worth is worth more than net worth. And everyone says, yeah, that's right, yeah. Think about it. That's very hard to achieve. When you're in a culture that puts so much value on what do you do for a living, and how much money do you make, and how many trinkets do you have, it's very difficult to feel self-worth when there isn't a whole lot of net worth. And what the Torah says is that we're going to create these spaces in time based on seven, this chidush of the Torah of measuring these artificial units of seven, because no month and no year ever divides by seven. And the whole purpose of it is to allow perhaps those that aren't so successful during the sixes of those periods to now feel that they are worth just as much, because those are the periods in which we dedicate ourselves to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Those are periods in which what really counts is not our net worth, but our self-worth. So we've spoken about how the Torah, when we look at what happened in the ancient Near East, really revolutionized political office and revolutionized economic policy. The things that we've mentioned now, we've all known. I haven't spoken about a single mitzvah that you guys didn't know about. But we see them now in a different way. We're able to appreciate there's a larger system coming to work here. When we see how different it was and how revolutionary it was and how it adapted things that we had in the ancient Near East. Let me talk now about what I mentioned, the technology of communication. What on earth is he talking about? This is a blowaway. This is just the coolest thing. I want to talk for a moment about the printing press. Many say that prior to the computer, maybe the most important invention in history was the printing press. And why is that? Because with the invention of the printing press, then you could have literacy. And with literacy, you have education. And with education, you have the exchange of ideas. And you have economic activity. The printing press allowed for all those things. Basically, it allowed literacy to flourish, to teach people to read and write. Because before that, you know, parchment and scribes, very expensive. Most people didn't have literacy. Now, what's really fascinating about the printing press, I'll explain why I'm talking about the printing press, but it has to do with the Torah in a minute, but what's really interesting, when you look at the history of the printing press, you see something really fascinating. Around the year 1500, some 50 years after the printing press had been invented, it was known the world over. When I say the world, I'm not including China, because we don't care about China. I'm speaking about just, you know, the Western world, okay? The Western world, everybody knew about the printing press. It was known in Western Europe, it was known in Eastern Europe, and it was known in the Ottoman Empire. And yet, the printing press had a radically different impact in Western Europe than it did in Eastern Europe, than it did in the Ottoman Empire. Why is that? In Western Europe, they used the printing press. They translated everything. They taught people to read and write. Do you know why? Because in Western Europe around the year 1500, anyone know what was happening around then? Excellent, the Protestant Reformation. Luther came along and said, every single person should have a connection with the Almighty. We don't need the Pope. We don't need the clergy. All you need to do is open up your Bible, read it, and you will have a connection with the... Ah, you don't know how to read and write? Great. Let's print out Bibles. Let's translate them into all the languages of Western Europe. And so where the Protestant Reformation took hold, the printing press took off. And the Protestant Reformation took hold because there was a willingness within it to empower the common person. That's what it was all about. Let's get rid of all these popes and clergy people. let's empower the common person. But in Eastern Europe, there was no Protestant Reformation. There, they stuck to Catholicism. There, they were very reluctant to translate the Bibles, to teach people how to read and write. What, the common people are going to open Holy Scripture? They'll make a mockery of it. What are they going to understand? So we want to leave, in Eastern Europe, they said, we want to leave Holy Scripture in Latin and let the clergy be the only ones who can read it. And in the Ottoman Empire, they were so afraid of empowering the masses with the power of literacy that it was a sin. It was a sin to use the printing press. And we see the results of that to this very day. Western Europe, relatively speaking, is very economically developed. Eastern Europe, less so. And the Arabs, all their GDP together adds up to Spain, as if Spain is some big economic powerhouse. It all goes back to this decision. In the year 1500, do we encourage literacy or do we not? So what we see from this is that you can have a technology of communication. Everyone knew how to turn the crank to use the printing press, but it's not enough. Because it only really gives its fruits. You only feel its full results if there's a readiness culturally to empower the masses. Well, that's it for our history lesson on the printing press. Now, let's get back to Torah. What's this got to do with the Torah? It's got to do the following. No less revolutionary than the printing press was in the year 1500, in the ancient world, we also have a similar revolution in technology of communication. Can anybody think what I'm talking about?
The chiyuv to write a Torah.
Well, that's not a technology of communication. It's called the alphabet. Let me explain. Writing systems were very ancient. We've all seen little pictures of cuneiform, you know, those little arrows and wedges that are stuck together that look like this couldn't possibly be anything, but it was. And we're all familiar with hieroglyphics, you know, those pictures of the guys going like this and like this, you know. So all those systems of writing were extremely cumbersome. Hundreds and thousands of signs and symbols. It took years to be able to even learn the beginning, the rudimentary of levels of how to read that stuff, which meant that very few people knew how to read and write. And this was deliberate. Because reading and writing is power. You're all here to get an education. The more education you have, the more powerful you are. We all know that. And they knew that back then. And so they used writing systems that were so difficult that only by investing in somebody, a scribe, to teach him to read and write, would anybody be able to read and write. And so it was reading and writing was exclusively done in Mesopotamia and in Egypt in the service of the palace and in the service of the temple. Common people did not know how to read and write. At some point prior to Am Yisrael, the alphabet was invented. But even when it was invented, it was only used by palaces and temples in other places around ancient Israel. The chiddush of Am Yisrael was to realize, hey, this little device has enormous, this little device here I'm calling the alphabet, okay? And my apologies to whoever put this here, but hey, you got to use it properly when you have one. Wow, this is amazing. Do you know what I can do with this? I have no idea. I don't know what my kids run around with this, but do you know what you can do with this? This is incredibly powerful, this alphabet. Do you know why? Because not only is it that it's easier, obviously we all know the alphabet is real easy. You can teach any five-year-old in about a day or two to read and write. What it means is that we can make many people literate. It means that we can write down texts and hand them out and have people learn about their history and learn about their ideas. The Torah is the first time in history, the Tanakh as a whole, the first time in history that texts were written down and disseminated to the masses to give them ideas, to give them culture, to educate them. Am Yisrael was encouraged at all points in its history to learn how to read and write. But this could only happen, as I said, the alphabet existed, but other cultures wanted to keep it close to the chest. What, the common people should know how to read and write? That's dangerous. But we have always believed in the common person. And so the Torah encourages the multiplication of texts and handing them out and teaching people to read and write. And so what we have is a radically different view of writing and who writing should be for, and that we should make it as easy as possible to empower the masses that are out there. So we've seen how this thing cuts across everything, empowering the masses, taking away power from the elites. It's in political office. It's in economic policy. It's in technology of communication. And now I want to finish with one idea about how it is actually in the very core of our relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. I wish to speak for a moment not about the Torah. I want to tell you hardcore stuff about Avodah Zarah. Okay? We have invited a speaker to speak to you about Avodah Zarah, what it's really about, okay, and how it works. Well, we all know, okay, so they have lots of gods and we have Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad. True, but I want to help you understand what this business is that they have lots of gods, because it seems kind of foolish. It certainly does. Let me explain something about what we see when we look at how religions functioned in all of the cultures of the ancient Near East. And I'll do it by kind of a way of an analogy. Imagine that we are archaeologists, and we have dug up an ancient culture called America. And we come across a clay tablet that describes the religion of this ancient culture, America. This is what we would find. We would find that there were many gods. The top god, the chief god, was called Commander-in-Chief. And we would find that Commander-in-Chief lived in a heavenly temple called White House. And then we would find that Commander-in-Chief was married to a goddess, and some scholars believe that she had a keen aesthetic sense, and some aren't sure about that. Okay. And then we would find that in this ancient culture of America, that there were other gods. In fact, there were exactly 535 other gods, local deities, and they lived in a domed temple, and they would always scheme and plot with each other. And sometimes, when they were really peeved at Commander-in-Chief, they could boot him out of his office. This is what we would find described about the religion of this ancient culture, its religion. And if we dug up an ancient culture called England, we would find the same thing. We would find that its chief god was called Prime Minister. We would find that Prime Minister lived in a heavenly temple called 10 Downing Street. We would find that there were other gods. There were Lord gods and there were common gods. Get the idea? In other words, what we find in every culture in the ancient Near East, maybe not Egypt, but you can read the book about why that might be, but every other culture in the ancient Near East, when they looked up, and they saw all these gods, what they really saw was their own political structures mirrored up in the heaven. It's true. This is true everywhere. Do you know why that is? Because it's a way in which earthly kings can say to their people, of course I'm king. Of course I live in a big fancy palace. Of course I have lots of ministers. And I have lots and lots of servants working for me. That's the way it is in Shemayim as well. So what they do in Shemayim is perfect. And so we're just a copy of the perfect system up in the sky. I mean, of course, it works the other way around, right? They imposed upon the sky what they had down here. But this is how they were able to explain and legitimate their own power. Now, what do we have in the Torah? This is all put aside because the Kadosh Baruch Hu is above and different entirely. In the Torah's ideal system, it's not even clear that there's a king. King is an option. And so no earthly leader in the Torah is able to say, well, I'm just doing what the King of Kings does. I'm a small version of the King of Kings, the way it was everywhere else. And so this even comes through in terms of theology, that everywhere else, the theology was a way in which they could legitimate their own earthly rule. But the Torah does away with that as well. And so to just wrap it up, I want to come back to the joke that we opened up with about this poor guy who goes to his rabbi and wants to be a Kohen. What do we do with that when we have Kohanim? That seems very hierarchical. Can't be a Kohen unless you're a Kohen. And my answer to that, and with this I'll finish, is this. Just like the Torah has an idea of a king, but it's really watered down relative to what kings were everywhere else, it's really the same with Kohanim. If you decided you wanted to be a priest somewhere in the ancient Near East, and you were comparing the benefits packages that different cultures offered you, the last place you would want to be a priest is in the Torah. It's terrible. You don't own land. Everywhere else, the priests own all the land. Well, how many animals are they bringing to the temple? How much meat am I going to get? Oh my gosh, the Torah is on a diet relative to the temples of the ancient Near East. I mean, hundreds of fat bullocks all the time. I mean, the Torah has very few animals relative to other cultures. What do they say about my forefathers in the Torah? Well, let's see. Aaron, he built the Egel. Nadav Aviu, they did Esh Zara. You know, you don't have these great, the Kohanim. Oh. No, in fact, the Kohanim are cut down to size. Well, what about the secrets of the temple? Do we get to abuse that because no one knows what's going on? Answer, no. It's all written in Sefer Vayikra. It's all out in the open. You can't do anything more than what's written there because everyone knows about it. So what we have about Kehuna is the same about Melucha. There were kings, but they were cut down to size. And there were Kohanim. They too were cut down to size. So leaving the mass of the people with all the power. You can't get to anything that I've said unless you look at the ancient Near East. And when you do, so many mitzvot, so many ideas that we're all familiar with suddenly take on a new light. So when we ask the question, learning the Torah in light of the ancient Near East, is it asur, reshut, or chovah? You've heard my answer here this evening. Thank you very much.
I hate this thing. Okay, fine.
Oh, there. That's a technology of communication.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have a few questions, and then afterwards, Professor Berman has agreed to stay around a little bit afterwards.
Yeah.
But we'll take a few questions now. Anyway. Yeah.
Just like with this way of reading the Torah in mind, do you think that practically or halakhically rather does or should affect the way that we grow?
I'm sorry, did it what?
That like affects the way that we grow our lives, halakhically or
practically. Wow, that's really interesting. Huh. when I've given this talk and things that have been written about the book, I've on more than one occasion heard the following observation. Yeah, you know, it's just like in shul, you know? People come to shul, they have rich people sitting next to poor people in shul, and nobody knows the difference. And then other people say, what are you talking about? Everyone knows what's going on in shul, who's the rich people and who aren't. I can tell you, I mean, this is one of the really wonderful things that I am thankful to the Borei Olam for the opportunity to live in Eretz Yisrael. I'm in chinuch, so you know that my salary is not amazing. I have no complaints. Hashem, I provide amply for my family. I'm not rolling in it. In my community, there are people who have a lot more than I do, and it's just not felt. I've never once, it's not because I'm a tzaddik, I've never once thought, gosh, wish I could have what the neighbors across the street have, or they have more. I think that in Eretz Yisrael, where people are really striving to live, in a more pure way, certainly a less materialistic way, the difference between the haves and the have-nots in the Dati community in Israel is virtually not felt at all. So I feel that these messages really do come through where I live. Here, I don't know if it's the same. I leave that for you to judge for yourselves. But I think it's an ideal, and I think in Israel it is felt. Certainly also, you know, there's just a sense in Israel that we're all in it together. So things like army, it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, everyone's going to do the army. You know, it's understood. So I think that it's a type of impetus that stems from these things, even if someone hasn't heard the talk that I gave tonight. Since it comes through in so many ways, I think that in Israel especially, it's something that's really realized in our time. Okay. Yes?
I guess going back to the beginning of the talk, you mentioned the various Yisroel Man King to so the Pesukim themselves do give reasons for these Yisurim, which aren't exactly the reason that you gave.
Lo Yasur Levavo.
Right. Or
that's given with
on the timeline in terms of horses.
There's two separate things there. There's Lo Yarbelu Susim, that's one, and then there's Lo Yashiva to Amit Sraima, the Man Harbot Sus. Those are two separate things.
You're saying those are two Yisurim?
I think so. Yeah.
What's the core in Torah for this idea that we believe in the salvation of Torah in the written and literal sense? Like that people should be reading and writing.
Okay. I thank you for that question. There's no mitzvah to teach your kids Aleph Bet. And the fact is that archaeologists and biblicists, when we look at the record of what actually went on in ancient Israel, it would appear that probably no more than 5 to 10% of Am Yisrael, for most of Bayit Rishon, knew how to read and write. But I need to make a very important distinction here. If I say to you, who has access to texts? My notes, the Chumash, who has access to this text? Today we would say, well, anyone who knows how to read and write. If you know how to read and write, you can open this sefer or any sefer and read. If you don't know how to write, then this is blocked from you. That was not the case in the ancient world. How do I know this? Watch, this is beautiful. Think of the Hebrew word mikro. Okay, the shorish kuf, resh, aleph. What does that shorish mean? To read and to call, right? It's two things that seem to have nothing to do with one another. Reading and calling out. In fact, those are almost opposite, right? The answer is that in the ancient world, likro, to call out, reading is almost always done out loud. In other words, today all reading is done as meditation on a piece of paper. But by just having a few people around who know how to literally read and write, many people can have access to a text. Because one person gets up, and this is the way Shul is set up this way. This is what Kriyat HaTorah is about. This is what Chazarat HaShatz is about. Maybe only a few people know the tool of literacy, but the text that's being read is read aloud, and hence reading and calling are one activity. And in this way, the text reaches many, many people. Okay? So by the fact that Moshe reads the Torah to Bnei Yisrael at Har Sinai, the fact that we have Hakel, the fact that we have Veshinatam Levanecha V'dibarta Bam, all these things imply that it's a good thing to be able to read. There are some places in the Nevi'im, in Habakkuk, the Nevi is told, take the Nevuah you just heard, go to the town square, and write it on a blackboard, basically. And then people will come along and read it, and then run elsewhere, and they will call it out. Okay? So it's there not as a chiyuv, necessarily, but it's something that's encouraged. And it's encouraged because we like to empower the masses. Yeah, we're just about that. Hey, let me just say I come in to the States from time to time, and I like speaking to groups. If any of you think that the things that we've heard here tonight or other things might be of interest in places that you have affiliations with, I would be happy to speak with you or pass you on my email, and we can hopefully learn again in the future. So I thank you all for coming out tonight, for your attentiveness, and I wish you hatzlacha rabbah.
I would like to thank Professor Berman for his insightful lecture and for giving us of his valuable time. I'd like to thank everyone for coming. Oh, by the way, I'm Jonathan Ziering, one of the associate editors for Kol Mavasser. Like we said before, Professor Berman will stay around a little bit afterwards if anyone has any more questions. Just to reiterate some of the points Shlomo made at the beginning, our next two issues, the next one will be on the year in Israel. The submission date is, I believe, November 29th. The first one of the spring semester will be on issues of war and what do we call it? And Jewish thought. We welcome submissions, and you can send it to our email account at kolmavasser@gmail.com. There are copies of our last issue, Judaism and its relationship to nature, on the back table, and in the future we will be having more lectures and other events, and you can find out about them from our website, from our Facebook page, from Science Around YU, from Y Studs, S Studs, R Studs, BR Studs, whatever exactly, we'll let you know. So just keep an eye out for that, and keep out for the our next issue will be coming out this coming week on Derech HaLimud. And thank you everyone for coming. Oh, this thing's always too tall. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.